This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, it's our last new show, but we're not the only ones letting go. The Anchorage Daily News is dropping rural delivery, a mom lets go of some stuff to move in with her grown daughter, and the Chipmunks let go of some music rights. All that and more coming up on AK. Welcome to AK. I'm Jessica Cochran. This week marks AK's last new show. You may hear a rerun here or there, but the staff will be gone and there won't be any new production. The whole media world is going through a bit of turmoil, you might call it, or maybe it's an overhaul. Cutbacks at NPR, most major newspapers. The Juneau Empire announced some this week, and later this month, the Anchorage Daily News will stop shipping to many communities. Fairbanks, Juneau, Valdez, and Prudhoe Bay will continue getting daily delivery. So will towns where the paper can be trucked. But places like Sitka that depend on air shipments will have to rely on direct mail or online subscriptions. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock has more.
We're heading to air cargo right now, and we're going to go pick up the Anchorage Daily News. The plane is about 20 minutes late, so I'm hoping that they have offloaded the papers by now.
Almost every day for the past 6 years, Kim Gleason has made this trip to Alaska Airlines Air Cargo in Sitka. In fact, for almost 20 years, a succession of Sitka moms have made a decent supplement to their family's income by taking on the Anchorage Daily News paper delivery in town. But over the years, there have been changes.
The little drive to air cargo, which started as a four-hour newspaper route, which has now been whittled down to a one-hour newspaper route.
And will soon be whittled down to...
to nothing as of December 28th.
The Anchorage Daily News says air freight costs are too high, so unless a rural store wants to handle shipping, they really can't afford to keep sending out papers. Driving the route with Kim on this rare sunny day, it becomes clear pretty quickly that the simple act of delivering the newspaper means more to Sitka than meets the eye.
Are you going to miss helping her load up these papers?
I'm going to miss Kim coming around here every day.
Yeah.
You get to know a lot of people all around town. And when the papers used to come in early in the morning, you'd see the people who are up early in the morning who you usually don't see, like the people at the grocery stores and the kind of the behind-the-scenes people around town. It was the little Mr. Rogers, who are the people in your neighborhood? That's what it reminded me of, because it was people that you meet when you're walking down the street.
Kim says what people don't understand is that she isn't just a delivery person for the ADN.
A lot of people think that I get a paycheck from the Anchorage paper or the Anchorage Daily News, and I don't. I actually buy the paper and I resell the paper. So it's my very own business. So people are taking papers without paying, or which happens a lot in the machines, then that's money that I lose. So by the Anchorage people are not coming to Sitka anymore, I am losing a business that I have been running for 6 years.
A business that fits really well with raising three children.
But this has been great because I've been able to do this and I could be with my kids could come with me, and I don't have to pay $4 an hour per kid to be in daycare or preschool, because I would have lost money doing that. Okay, Kaya, you need to hold these.
Case in point, 7-year-old Kaya is out of school today with a stomach ache, but she's not too sick to help out with the route.
Oh, okay, Kaya, you just dropped a whole bundle of papers, but you got a new bundle there?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, how are your arms? You're able to hold them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This time I am.
Have you ever dropped them before?
No, this is my first time. Yay!
This is actually the slow season for paper sales, and Kim says sometimes in the winter she has debated whether the route is really worth it. But then summer rolls around.
I have to say the cruise ships have really helped keep this whole business alive, because I sell two to three times as many papers in the summer than I do in the winter.
For some of Kim's customers, it seems that the small town exchange between patron and paper carrier is going to be missed almost as much as the paper itself.
I think it's a bummer. I'm going to miss it. I get it every day except Sundays. Sometimes I don't get Sundays, but I'm sure going to miss it.
Oh, I think your paper is being run over here, hand-delivered through your truck window.
Somewhere we can figure out how to
there
get
you
it.
Go, dear. Yes, stay in today.
Hey, thanks, sweetheart. Here. Okay. I'll come in and pay in a minute.
Okay, no worries.
Yeah, I wish it was somewhere we could figure to get it, even if it did cost. I'd better pay 25 cents more and get it.
Even Kim admits that the high price of fuel and other factors caused her to stop doing home deliveries. And she just doesn't see how she could also absorb the cost of shipping.
What would it cost for it to get it?
$4.50.
A day?
They want to charge me $4 per paper.
Oh, wow.
To send it here, because they're losing too much money.
Well, even if it's guaranteed, what if you get enough customers to guarantee it?
Yeah, but who would pay more than $4 a paper?
I don't know.
The Anchorage Daily News Circulation Director, Roger Weinfurter, says the paper can still be mail-ordered. A first-class subscription costs about $2,000 a year. A second-class subscription will cost a quarter of that, but papers can take a week or more to arrive. A full electronic subscription is about $10 a month. One thing is certain, the news business and how people get their news is changing. Still, for big events, plenty of people want that printed newspaper headline. In Sitka, there is one Anchorage Daily News edition that history buffs can get, thanks to a former ADN carrier and a local collector of paraphernalia.
So the Anchorage paper finally came in, but it was 3 days late. And it was the headlines of 9/11, and it had the towers and the airplanes going through the towers, and the what I would think would be one of those most memorable newspapers you could ever buy. And because it was 3 days late, she decided not to put it out, so she threw it in the garbage can, and Bill Foster pulled them out. And if you would like to buy one today, he still has them. So you can purchase an actual 9/11 Anchorage Daily News newspaper from Bill Foster.
But after December 28th, it will be difficult to purchase an actual Anchorage Daily News newspaper anywhere else in town. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Maybe I can rustle up a job, but there's nothing I can do. My best working days are through, and I'm walking through your town.
Aliza Sherman Rizdahl is about to move from Alaska's biggest city to a much smaller town. She may still be able to get the newspaper, but there are other things she'll have to go without. She's no stranger to moves, but this one is causing her a little heartache.
I'm moving to Tok very soon. I've been in Anchorage now for 3 years and finally feel like I have connections here. I spent my first 2 years trying to get settled and thinking that I would never make it in Anchorage, much less Alaska. Now I don't want to leave. It's not that I'm afraid to move to Tok. I wasn't afraid to move to Anchorage, even though I was leaving a thriving business and good friends behind. I wasn't afraid to move to Wyoming from New York City after September 11th, even though I didn't know anyone. Or moving to New York City from North Carolina, even though I had never lived in a big city on my own. I guess what I'm saying is that I'm used to moving to new places. But what I've noticed as I get older is that I'm much more aware of what it means to leave something behind that is comfortable and familiar. More aware of what it feels like to leave people behind who I care about and want to be near. A little voice inside of me keeps cheering me on. This is an adventure, she says. If you make it there, you can make it anywhere. Yes, I know that moving to Tok doesn't mean I'll never see my friends in Anchorage again. In fact, I'll probably be back in town almost every month. But I also know that I have to start all over again in a new place. No matter how many times I've done it before, it somehow seems harder now. And making the most out of the move requires that I let go of my attachment to Anchorage. I can't hold on to thoughts of all the things I've found in the city and all the things that won't be available in more remote parts of the state, like Thai food, or decadent gourmet chocolates, or gluten-free goodies, or sitting amidst the hustle and bustle of the lunch crowd at my favorite Midtown cafe while I tap into their Wi-Fi to get some work done between client meetings. I have to let go of expectations and preconceived notions, like my fear that I'll have to take up baking to kill time while I wait for my emails to download on a slow rural internet connection, or that I'll go stir-crazy cooped up in the house with a toddler because there isn't any daycare in Tok and no way we'll be able to play outside when the temperatures drop to 40 or 50 below, or colder. I have to just open myself up to the experience. That little voice inside of me says, the end of one thing makes room for the start of another. If I'm going to make it in Tok, I think I need to listen to her. I'm Aliza Sherman Rizdal.
The longer you live in a place, the greater the danger that stuff will start piling up. And it's pretty easy to ignore it's there until it's time to move. Recently, Shanna Sheehy's mom found herself in this situation, and the idea of getting rid of any of her things was pretty overwhelming. We'll check in on Shanna and her mom, Betty Rafson, a few times today as they go through the process of letting go.
Well, I'm about to make a move tomorrow, and tomorrow I'm moving from a small house to a smaller place, and I want to only have the things that really matter and that are irreplaceable. And even though that seems like it should be simple enough, when it gets right down to it and you're looking item per item and there's something that doesn't fit that category, but it's sure pretty or there's nothing wrong with it, it's just hard to say, no, I don't want that. But you do reach a point where it's ridiculous to store all these things that, oh, it's just too good to throw away when you don't really need it, because then it's just something that you worry about. You worry about your stuff. And you are always trying to find room for your stuff. And you don't need it.
Mom, are you a hoarder?
Am I a what?
Oh, a hoarder.
Right, a hoarder.
I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Anyway, yes, I do have a tendency to hang on to things. But really, I know before I go over there tomorrow and do the final sorting that all of it is irreplaceable are pictures, just special cards, special letters, things that remind me of good things.
Mm-hmm. So if tomorrow you leave with just those special things, what do you think you'll have lost?
I'll have lost a lot of pressure from having all that stuff that I don't know what to do with. And it'll feel really good, and I'll think, why didn't I do that a long time ago?
So that actually sounds like a gain.
I think it could be a very good thing. I think I'll be really glad when I do it. I'm going to do it. It's not an if. When I actually do it, I'll be glad that I did it.
Coming up after the break, investigating the oozy rock-eating substance inside a southeast cave. Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. Our theme this week is letting go, but one of our regular contributors, Ed Schoenfeld, took that as let me go underground again. Ed's fascinated with caves, maybe even a little bit obsessed. So he asked a geologist to show him something different in the fissures and tunnels under Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. What he found was moon milk, a formation that's living, growing rock.
There's no polite way to get into the narrow entrance of Wingate Cave.
So it sounds like backing in is the best way?
Backing in and coming down, I believe, is the best way to get over this thing. Unless you're small and flexible.
Which I am now.
But once I scramble inside, I see that things open up. There's a tall room, a stream underfoot, and a steep passageway reaching up to a higher entrance.
I'm looking at a crack in the side of the wall, and there's a white, almost foamy substance there. It's moon milk. It's part mineral, part bacteria, part who knows what. It's covering part of the side of this wall, almost all the way up to the ceiling.
Moon milk isn't really all that impressive to look at. It sort of reminds me of sprayed-on insulation, or toothpaste, or even curdled cottage cheese. But it's fascinating because it's a mineral feature that's packed full of living organisms. Forest Service geologist Jim Bechtel is fascinated, too.
Moon milk exists throughout the cave, but it's really prominent in these fractures that get up approaching the surface, like we're maybe 35, 40 feet below the forest above us. And all of the formations you see up there are soft, even though they look like stalagmites and stalactites and flowstones. They're moon milk. It's hydrous calcium carbonate formed by bacteriological activity.
Scientists are taking a hard look at what's on the walls of this cave and others on Prince of Wales Island because there's so much of it. This moon milk is dense, a yard deep in some places. Elsewhere around the world, it's often only a thin crust. But why do they care? Because this stuff actually eats rock. It doesn't need light or other plants or animals or any sort of organic material to survive. It's on a hard rock diet. To find out more, I called Penny Boston, a New Mexico-based microbiologist and expert on cave formations who's studying the moon milk in Wingate Cave.
The detailed chemistry and so forth is interesting scientifically, but the real message here is that these guys are chewing their way through bedrock and they're pooping out or reprecipitating in some fashion these unique formations.
Dozens of tiny organisms live in this stuff, including bacteria and fungi. Under a microscope, it looks like filaments woven around finned, rod-shaped crystals. But other versions exist around the world, and it isn't all the same.
You can get dry moon milk, you can get the pasty moon milk, you can get powdery moon milk. It's a cave formation that has multiple forms.
Geomicrobiologist Annette Summers Ingle is a scientist specializing in underground life forms. I reached her where she teaches at Louisiana State University. She's traveled to high elevation caves in Italy to find moon milk almost as dense as in Alaska. She says it may have something to do with the cold.
It could be a combination of the chemical conditions of the cave environment, the correct temperature, correct pH, correct concentration of different components in the water in some of these caves make the geochemistry and the mineralogy conducive for moon milk formation.
Some of the living components are from the surface or have close relatives above ground. But Boston, who works with the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, says others are more exotic.
In fact, in some of our caves, the closest relatives will be something very exotic like deep-sea hydrothermal vent organisms, or they'll be related to marine organisms.
And some of it, well, doesn't seem to be closely related to anything. Summers Ingle says some of the microorganisms may have evolved underground.
Certainly we know that animals that live in caves have had very rapid, over geologic time periods, very rapid evolution. So sure, microbes getting washed into the caves over geologic time periods may actually evolve into new species within the cave systems.
Scientists have known about moon milk for at least half a century, but recent advances in DNA and microscopic imaging have helped them understand how unusual this stuff is. Researchers such as Summers Ingle are considering its role in the underground food chain. They've found tiny beetles and other organisms that devour the even tinier critters found within the foamy white formation. Back in Alaska, geologist Jim Bechtel is interested in the role moon milk plays in the forest ecosystem. He knows trees grow taller over cave-pocketed areas. Maybe moon milk is the reason. Just inside Wingate Cave, he points to a foam-filled fissure.
It's completely packed with roots. The roots come right to the base of the moon milk, and just the nodes stick out. And it makes me wonder if there is a relationship between the bacteriological activity releasing nutrients to the trees, making it available to the trees, and also the fact that it's moist all the time. And so maybe the moon milk is the source for the water and the nutrients for this forest that's flourishing above.
Figuring that out might help scientists get a better handle on the health of the forest. Moon milk could also be useful in the study of geology, evolution, and climate change. Scientists are even examining it as they try to predict what life might be like on other planets. That's because it lives in extreme conditions, underground, away from sunlight and conventional food that might exist elsewhere in the solar system. For AK, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
Hear more about Southeast Alaska caves in Ed's documentary in the Encounters series. Go to our website for links to that program and other information on Alaska caves. We've also got photos of moon milk. It's at www.akradio.org. Time now to take one last weekly trip around the state. On today's segment of 300 Villages, we check in with the native village of Afognak.
No one lives there anymore, but many still think of it as home.
My name is Melissa Borton. I'm the tribal administrator for the Native Village of Afognak, and our offices are located in Kodiak as well. Our enrolled membership is about 335. At one point in time, Afognak had a very thriving village with over 300 residents. In 1964, with earthquake and tsunami, virtually destroyed the village. Many of the residents that did survive the earthquake and tsunami, and afterwards, as a community, made the decision to relocate the village, which is now what is called Port Lions. However, another portion of the community did not want to relocate to Port Lions, so they left the village and dispersed throughout the country and throughout Alaska. Really, those are the members that the Native Village of Afognak primarily serves. However, we do consider Port Lions a sister village, and we do share membership with a lot of our tribal members, and so we do collaborate on many of our projects. A program that's widely known as our Dig Afognak Summer Camp program. It is a summer youth camp. We operate 6 weeks, and it's actually held on Afognak Island. It's our way of reconnecting with our traditional lands and showing some of our youth who've never been in the old village, building that connection with them as well. And we have been working diligently to revitalize our language, and it is one of the components at camp that we do at every camp. Kids learn to speak the language. We also have an after-school program throughout the winter where we teach the language as well. And we're at a point now where a lot of our youth speak more of the language than people that are my age and older.
We heard from Melissa Borton of Afognak Native Corporation. 300 Villages has been AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Plenty of big names have covered the Chipmunks' famous Christmas song over the years, but the studio doesn't usually let the rights go to lesser-known performers. This year, a singer in the Aleutians changed that. Ann Hillman has more.
During Christmas time in 1958, people turned on the radio and heard this.
Christmas, Christmas time is near. Time for toys and time for cheer.
This year, people in Alaska will hear this instead.
Want a plane that loops the loop. And me, I want a hula hoop.
It's the Chipmunk song, re-released and redone. The original Chipmunk song was written by Ross Bagdasarian Sr., who liked experimenting with sped-up sounds. He wanted to give his rapid singing voices characters to bring them to life. Soon after, Alvin, Simon, and Theodore toddled onto the Ed Sullivan Show and brought the Chipmunks to fame. His son, Ross Jr., remembers growing up with the characters.
When we as kids first heard the Chipmunk song, we were just bowled over, mostly because of the audacity of Alvin talking back to this big, deep-throated voiced fellow, David Seville, that in spite of, you know, Dave yelling, Alvin, you know, Alvin didn't just go, oh, all right. He yelled back, in essence, okay.
He says the Chipmunks are some of the only characters to be born from songs. 50 years later, he and his wife voiced the Chipmunks and are releasing their second feature-length live-action film. And the classic song lives on in an un-Alaskan artist, Linda Liebeck Robinson, who is making her first Christmas CD.
I love the song, the Chipmunk song. It always makes me smile and think of when I was a child. And I would mention to people, yeah, I think I'm going to put the Chipmunk song on, and they would laugh. And one, of course, the first question they would ask is, well, are you going to alter your voice so it sounds like a chipmunk? And I said, absolutely not, because I think the song itself is adorable. It really stands on its own.
She wanted to couple the song with other more serious pieces, like Silent Night, sung in Aleut, and Two Carols, sung in Russian.
It's a real interesting sort of mix, because we've got some pretty serious, sophisticated pieces on this CD, and then you've got the Chipmunk song. The CD is a gift, and when gifts come under the tree, they're not all one thing. They're many things.
But when it came time to record the CD, An Aleutian Noel, she encountered complications. She had to rearrange her home studio space to make room for two foster children. Outside, there were building projects and oil rigs.
So I'd be recording at 1 o'clock in the morning and you'd hear, Captain John, line one. I mean, like at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Add to that, she was told by an assistant at Bagdasarian Productions that the likelihood of her getting the license for the Chipmunk song was low. Large companies don't have time for people like her. But she sent them an MP3 of the song, and by chance, Ross Bagdasarian Jr. himself listened to it.
And I really loved what she had done. And because it was so improbable that she would probably get an answer for the song, I just decided that, you know, the Chipmunks were born 50 years ago out of just good fortune and happenstance. And so I just thought I would pass the little miracle along.
He let go of the license so the Chipmunks could live on for another 50 years in the heart of the Aleutians. Alaska, I'm Ann Hillman for AK.
Earlier in the program, we heard from Betty Rafson, someone who's having a really hard time letting go of her things. Now she and her daughter, Shanna Sheehy, are getting down to the hard work of moving from one house to another.
It's the morning. I am headed to Grandma's car to start it up. Are you ready, Mom?
I'm ready. Oh, I'm ready as I'll ever be.
Should we do this thing?
Let's do it.
Okay, so we're on the way to Grandma's house, and Grandma just accidentally passed the street. Do you think that there's anything in that, Mom?
I was wondering if, that was Freudian or something, because I know where that street is. Is this avoidance?
Here we are.
Here we are.
So, Mom, we have how much time in there?
1 hour.
1 hour to go through and decide what you're going to keep, really, mostly.
Right.
We're looking at the positive.
I really, really want. And so we're approaching it from the what I'm going to keep instead of what I'm not going to keep. Let's go. Let's do it.
Okay, it is, it's only been 27 minutes, and we just finished one room, right?
Yeah, but I think the next room will be much faster. The rest of it will be faster.
So how did it feel, though?
Terrible. But in another day or two, this might seem fine. But right now, this is very, very difficult, and I'm just want to go to sleep.
How do you feel inside?
I'm afraid I'm going to be throwing away something I want. That I'll discover that there was something in a box that I forgot was in there, and I got rid of a box without looking at it close enough. I feel extremely tired, and I just want to go to sleep. I just want to get away from this.
Maybe accidentally forgetting to turn on the street was actually more significant than not.
Yeah, I really have been putting off doing this for a long time, and I'm not sure why, because if I knew why, I mean, everyone likes stuff, right? You buy stuff, you collect it over the years. You don't buy it because you don't want it. You buy it because you want it, right? And you, when you don't want it anymore, you throw it away. But if you still sort of like it, you just still have it. And then to throw away everything at once, it's sort of like, it's just crazy. This is extremely difficult for me. I hate it. The only reason I'm anywhere at all is because I've got you here sort of saying, let's keep moving.
Are you going to resent me after this is over?
No, I'm not. I'm going to be thankful. I'm going to be thankful and appreciate your patience.
More with Betty and Shanna after the break. Also, an eroding bank at Point Barrow lets go of a secret, and Tlingits hang on to the secrets that live in their language. Stay with us. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Jessica Cochran, and this week we're letting go. We've been following along as Shanna Sheehy and her mom Betty Rafson pick through Betty's things to decide what to keep and what to let go. What we haven't told you yet is where Betty is moving and why. She'll be living with Shanna and her family, Betty's son-in-law and two young grandsons, for a mix of reasons relating to liver problems and finances. So this move isn't just about letting go of the stuff she's accumulated. It's also letting go of her own space, the idea of being self-sufficient, and maybe in a way, her life's work. Because it turns out for Betty, stuff and the need to organize it is pretty ingrained.
I grew up in a house that was very disorganized, and I was the only one that tried to organize it. And I was constantly trying to organize it. And it kept on getting unorganized in front of me. And nobody had any appreciation for that. It's like, oh, it's Betty organizing again. And I guess I've never finished the job. I think maybe it's a way of putting things off in a way, because I keep on thinking, when I get organized, then I'll paint. When I get organized, then I'll write. But see, I want to paint and I want to write, so why would I do that?
That's a really good question.
I'm not really on the winning side of this until I have the rest of the sorting done and actually have done it. And so I'm not there yet, because I'm bringing stuff home that I'm going to be sorting a little bit. And unless I get that done, I didn't finish this.
If you were able to get all the stuff to your new place and then by the end of the year sort it all, or throw it all away, mm-hmm. so that, you know, let's say hypothetically you have no more boxes of things. Mm-hmm. It's just things that you use.
Then I'd pull out my paints and start painting.
You wouldn't feel like naked or something?
No, I'd feel freed up to do what I was waiting to do until I got organized.
So maybe that's it. I mean, maybe you don't want to be in a situation where you can just do whatever you want, because maybe you have fear of that, or maybe you don't think that's how you should spend your time, or I don't know, maybe you want the burden of stuff to keep you from doing stuff.
Well, that's deep. But I don't know, there might be something to it. I mean, you know, why would a person do that? I mean, there's got to be. So then you'd have to go way back and figure. I mean, if you wanted to do that, but if you're in the more modern day psychology, you would just go ahead and do the paints and not worry about why you took so long to get to it. Because you have to do what you can do now. In fact, this makes me think I should throw the rest of it away and start painting.
Betty Rafson now lives with her daughter, Shanna Sheehy, and family. She still has some boxes to go through, but she's also jumped into her creative side. She's working on a children's book with her writing and painting. This past summer, an eroding bank at Point Barrow's tip let a secret go, a pair of ancient wood sled runners. Claire Alix is an archaeologist working with the Nuvuk Archaeological Project, led by Ann Jensen. Claire has spent years studying how wood was used by Arctic peoples. She stopped by the StoryCorps booth in Barrow to talk with fellow scientist Hank Staswich about discovering these pieces of ancient wood sticking out of the bank.
At the beginning, actually, I thought it was a boat, because we had found a paddle. And so when we first saw the first little piece, I was thinking, well, maybe a cross piece, maybe we have a board here. Mm. And then the other piece, that at first, the stanchion piece, since I hadn't seen they were connected, I almost thought that it was like the upper deck parts of a kayak or something. But then all of a sudden I realized they were connected. And in fact, it was just, they were sled. And then I said, they're like the during sled runners. You know, I was like, yeah. Shit, you know?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Wow. Yeah. That is
and
such
so,
a great story.
And then they were complete. That's the amazing thing. for me, it's once in a lifetime discovery, really.
Wow.
Because I've been working on those questions for so long. But anyway, there's one site where wood is really well preserved from that archaeological culture, and it's Deering. It's a Kagi. And so I had seen, very briefly, but seen the collection in Copenhagen where they have found fragments of those sleds that are very similar to the one we found this summer.
Wow.
And so I recognized it in the field, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is what it is. And not only was there one, but there was two, and they were complete. They're not broken. And it was just, this is amazing.
It's going to be a museum piece somewhere. Oh, yeah. International.
I don't know about international, but at least it's just really a very rare discovery.
That's fantastic.
I mean, I was so lucky to be here,
wow,
to be the one that was finding this. And I mean, I wasn't alone, of course, you know, and it's a team project. And now the site is gone. I mean, it's...
Really? Has been washed to sea?
Yeah. It was right on the erosion front.
Right.
And that's the erosion that showed us that there was wood coming out. And we thought it was just natural driftwood, but I was interested, so we started excavating it.
Oh, yeah. Lucky day. What time of year was that?
That was this July.
This year?
July 18.
Wow.
No, it was just one of those amazing days. I mean, we were really in recovery mode the next day because we worked until 2:30 in the morning to, you know, retrieve the artifacts and get them out.
Claire Alix says the sled runners are 1,600 years old. They are the only intact pair from the Iputak culture. StoryCorps is a national oral history project gathering stories in Fairbanks, Barrow, Dillingham, Nome, and Unalaska. To tell your story, call 1-800-850-4406. StoryCorps will also be collecting stories in Juneau. No doubt the people we'll hear from next could give them a handful. It's a get-together of Tlingit speakers who don't want to let the language go. Scott Burton has more.
Close to 20 people have assembled in Juneau to speak Tlingit at a new get-together. Participant David Katzik says although there are other language revitalization efforts, this gathering is unique because it's not affiliated with any organizations.
Merry Christmas.
The gathering that's taking place right now, the thing that I think that's a real progress is that the people are getting together without having to have a grant from whatever source there is, but to come together because we really, really know that our language is very strong, that it does have life in it, and that the language is beautiful.
The participants are young and elderly, fluent speakers, learners, listeners, native and non-native. Among them is Mary Folletti, who is taking notes and asking the elders questions. She's finishing her master's degree in elementary education and studied Tlingit in language camps growing up and in college. It makes her feel good to speak the language, and she hopes to pass it on to her students. But she had her path questioned once, on a test drive.
The car salesman was asking me what I was doing with my life, and I told him, you know, my interest in the language and culture. And he asked me, why is it that you're teaching and learning a language that nobody else speaks? And he caught me off guard. I stumbled. I mean, I really stumbled over myself because I was like, wow. I mean, I felt like it was almost like a racist question. Like, why would you ask a question like that? But at the same time, it's a good question.
She says her answer to the salesperson now would be the feeling she got here at the language group. And why it feels so good to be here may be because it's been designed as a safe place to speak. Dr. Alice Taff helped conceive this time for speaking and is a research assistant professor of Alaska Native Languages at the University of Alaska Southeast.
The reason that we need a safe place is because
the history of language abuse all the way across this continent and state and elsewhere in the world is such that people have been murdered and maimed and tortured and humiliated, and their economic support has been cut off because they've used their language. And every person in that room Sunday can give you the story, and this is the real story that I haven't heard anybody collect, and I haven't done it myself. Their own story of their own language abuse.
But the room where the participants are this month is not as safe as it is convenient. It was donated, has a kitchen where they prepared a variety of native foods and is wheelchair accessible, but it's in a church. Dr. Nora Downhauer is a participant and no stranger to language abuse.
What I learned along the way is that God didn't like Tlingit. God don't like Tlingit speakers, Tlingit speaking.
And so in the future, could this language time feel safer or feel better if it was not in a church?
I think it would have felt better. We could have been freer.
The language developed over thousands of years, says Dr. Taff, and became the foundation for a complex social system and a relationship with the land.
There's so much that we can learn about how to live with other people and how to live with the land. In the endangered language field, there's the abbreviation of one of the reasons to maintain these languages is the cure for cancer. Okay, and what that is shorthand for is indigenous knowledge about local plant lore, that if we lose it, like the Middle Ages when we lost so much knowledge because the plague and what was going on, we don't want to lose that indigenous knowledge that can help society on planet Earth move forward.
The next time for Speaking Tlingit is on January 17th at the Northern Lights United Church in Juneau, and David Katzik hopes people who want to be around the language and the culture will come.
The thing that I would like to say, you do a ich, anyatusan. You're invited.
For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
It's the time of year when people get together a lot, reenacting traditions, remembering the past. In her poem, Bethel at Christmas, Fairbanks-based poet Carolyn Kramers recalls spending the season there. It's read here by Chris Pastrow.
Like the full moon, full as a heart of new and old friends, we encircle the Christmas tree. Yupiks and gussocks drinking boxed wine in this damp town, Mum de Ulamut, where every drop of liquor is hand-carried or home-brewed. Some sip sodas, coffee, or tea, some the pale pink plash. And talk touches health aides on call night and day, villages the size of thumbnails, a favorite place you go to pick blueberries in the fall time, and marvel that so-and-so met so-and-so in Hawaii. How people are different. How snow creaks under skis. The tundra in the full moon looks like desert, like white sand, sagebrush, tumbleweeds. The snow gives in the dark its sudden hills, and you glide without thought or lover. Rabbit fur hat blocking wind. Tonight, at the Christmas party, someone tells of skiing the bluffs towards Napakiak. Take a left turn and there will be dog teams stringing the horizon. A sudden moment of hugging and knowing, yes, we change in this riverine town, swallowed by sky, willow bushes taller than human heads. An occasional spruce and, here, the Christmas party house built with logs that drifted downriver. Each with a story we will never know. Can only imagine and smile, saying, Yes, it was a good evening. Yes, we should do this more often. Yes, 40-mile gusts may keep us from running the K-12 tomorrow, day of the Mink Festival. Come Sunday, homemade cookies for sale at the high school. $5 a pound. Piano recital with friends. The wind picking up. Cerise sundown. Colored lights in the foam dome star-shaped window. Dilute. Give thanks for this glory of night and season. This heart full of ache and peace. This place.
Carolyn Kramers is spending the year near Lake Baikal in Russia. Her friend Chris Pastro read her poem, Bethel at Christmas.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
I came back from vacation a couple of weeks ago to find a termination packet in my mailbox at work. All the information about how to continue healthcare coverage and roll over my 401k after my employment here ends. Instructions to turn in my keys on my last day. A few days later, my name had been removed from the employee sign-in sheet at the front desk. I knew these things were coming. It's been clear for some time that new funding for AK wasn't going to materialize, and that was before the economy really went south and NPR announced big cutbacks. For even longer, I've known that I need to find new energy and a new project to spend it on. I'd actually given notice weeks earlier. But these little gestures still felt like small slaps in the face, though I know they weren't intended to be. Now I'm grateful. I think I needed those slaps to begin to let go of this show and this job. I've worked on AK since before it was born, so to speak. I was asked to help produce the pilot for the show, called Weekend Alaska back then, and I've served as its producer ever since, more than 5 years, minus a couple of maternity leaves. I won't pretend letting go of the show is as difficult as it will someday be to let those two kids grow up and leave home. But it is hard to remember the time before my life was dominated by a weekly cycle of deadlines and themes and edits, and hard to imagine what it will feel like without them. There are some things I won't let go of. I refuse to. The things that have made this job worth all the effort. A string of amazing, talented, funny co-workers, former hosts Shelley Wozniak, Gabriel Spitzer, and Rebecca Shear, reporters Ellen Lockyer, Ashley Gross, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, and Scott Burton, engineers John Nelson, Shelley again, and Gooseberry Peter. Life is pretty good when, while you're working, you're laughing so hard the tears roll down your cheeks. There are too many contributors from around the state to name, reporters based at member stations, yes, but also people who just showed up, wanting to learn to do radio, with an idea for a story in mind. Some stuck around for a while, volunteering their time to help us out. Amanda Compton, Emily Butler. Others wrote poems or essays, or stumbled around with recording equipment. All were motivated by the same thing we are motivated by, a desire to tell the stories of the people of Alaska. I refuse to let go of the idea that telling these stories is important, that it serves a purpose and fulfills a need, even if we don't know we have it. I hope someday Alaska finds another venue for the kinds of stories that AK tells, stories that aren't, strictly speaking, news. And I hope someday I can be involved in it, whatever the format is. So I guess I'm letting go of this show, but I'm not saying goodbye. Thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Cochran.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.